This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Fred Moten flunked out of Harvard in 1981 and wound up working as a janitor at the Nevada nuclear test site during the Cold War. It was a job that taught him how to avoid work, and that might have been the end of the story. But after hours and hours of doing nothing and trying not to get caught, he heard his muse. Fred Moten discovered poetry. He wrote thousands of poems that year at the site. Today, Fred Moten is a poet and a professor of modern poetry at Duke University and joins us today on The State of Things. Welcome. So good to have you here.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
I want to take you back to growing up in Las Vegas in the 1960s, the late 60s. What was the political climate there?
Well, I guess you kind of have to go back a little bit further than that even. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, Las Vegas was known as the Mississippi of the West, so it was still a pretty highly segregated place. There was a growing black community in Las Vegas that found itself dealing with struggles that were not necessarily very different from the kinds of struggles that black folks were undergoing in the South and also in other major northern cities. And so there was definitely a kind of liberation struggle in Las Vegas. It corresponded with the black liberation struggle all over the country. And that was the sort of atmosphere within which I grew up.
It's interesting you say a growing black population. That is, suggests that that African-Americans were attracted to Las Vegas. This wasn't a population that was indigenous in any way. What happened? What accounted for that?
Well, I think there were several factors. First of all, the gaming industry. So that in the 1940s and 50s, when Las Vegas became a major sort of entertainment capital, there needed to be an infrastructure of workers, people who could easily be called unskilled workers, to clean up hotel rooms, to clean up the casino floors, so on and so forth. But there was also a big union presence. The Culinary Union was one of the major unions in Vegas. And so that it was a place where, again, folks who were called unskilled laborers could move, find a job. The job was relatively stable because it was unionized. The wages were relatively good. The cost of living was relatively low, so people could come and buy a house and raise their families. And so it attracted a lot of working people, including black working people from the South.
And it included, when you talk about that culinary union, that was a pretty broad umbrella. And a lot of people in the hospitality industry.
Exactly. And not just the hospitality industry, but also the culinary union. A lot of the jobs at the Nevada test site were culinary union jobs. And I don't know if civilian jobs in the military bases were, but there's a huge Air Force base in North Las Vegas called Nellis Air Force Base, which also attracted a lot of workers, too. And even up till the last 10 or 12 years, Vegas was is a union town in many ways.
So your mother was very active and influential in politics in Las Vegas. Tell us about her activism.
Well, again, that activism goes back to her roots in the South in Arkansas. She was from a small town in southeastern Arkansas called Kingsland. She went to University of, well, what was called Arkansas AM&N, but it's now the University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff. And then from there went to graduate school at the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, which was still, I guess you could say, partially segregated insofar as black students were admitted. But she ended up, much of the time she was there, staying in the basement of an empty building because there was segregated. The living accommodations were still segregated. So, and then she transferred from there to University of Arkansas, Little Rock, which was right around the time that Little Rock Central school desegregation issues were emerging, and then that fight was happening. And she was sort of peripherally involved there along with some of her fellow graduate students. So by the time she got to Las Vegas, she had a kind of background, you know, again, in a sort of liberation struggle. And I should say that my understanding of it, at least, is that to be black in the South in the 1950s was to be involved in a liberation struggle, whether it was in an explicit way or not. So she brought that background with her
Let's talk about that explicit involvement, because it's kind of interesting, and maybe this is hindsight and not feeling that milieu where everybody was involved if you were African-American. Mm-hmm. A woman coming from Arkansas, having had – was she the first in her family to have a college education? She may not have been.
It depends on what you mean by family. Certainly, she was an only child, my grandfather and grandmother didn't go to college. My grandfather had a sister whose daughter also went to college. So I think they were probably the first two from that extended family who went.
But she moves. Now she's in a place like Las Vegas. Her first job was – she ended up teaching, but she didn't start out as a teacher, right?
No. When she moved to Las Vegas, there were very few teaching jobs for black teachers. The schools were still segregated. My mother was trained as a secondary school teacher, and there were no – jobs available for black teachers teaching in high school. So she did day work for a long time. And luckily, I suppose, she ended up working, cleaning up the house of a woman whose husband was, I think, the president of the local school board. And that's how she ended up getting on the substitute teachers list and then eventually started teaching in a black school in the predominantly black community in Las Vegas, which is called the West Side, a school called Madison Elementary School, where she taught for probably the first 6 or 7 years of her career.
She became very active in desegregating the Las Vegas schools to the point where you were in a lot of meetings and running around in your pajamas and sometimes sleeping in your pajamas. Tell us about her activism. What kinds of things she was doing?
When the school desegregation fight began, she, along with a few other teachers and community activists, there was a pretty active NAACP chapter. She also got involved with the League of Women Voters, who were primarily white women, who there was a kind of coalition of women and some men who were very much invested in the school desegregation process. I think a lot of that activism came also out of political activism. The United States Senate, passed the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Bill in 64 and 65. And one of the primary, there was a senator from Nevada named Howard Cannon, who actually voted for those bills and supported those bills. And there was a tremendous amount of black community support for Cannon in a sort of election year process in which it was very tight. He was running for Senate against, I believe, Paul Laxalt, who was governor at the time, who later became sort of famous as one of Reagan's best friends. So there was a lot of political activity that happened at that moment that then the school desegregation activity kind of emerged from. And my mom was very much involved with that as a teacher, and very much involved in it as a The term that I remember her using so much was equal educational opportunity, right? And she simply recognized that the sort of separate but equal philosophy that had already proven to be both sort of morally corrupt but also on a policy level completely inequitable, she understood that that was also the case in Las Vegas too, and that equal educational opportunity demanded some form of school desegregation, mm-hmm. and so her experience as a teacher sort of showed her this.
Well, civil rights as integration was bumping right up against a more militant form of civil rights, a black nationalism that was arising at about the same time. The Black Panthers got started, the Las Vegas chapter got started kind of in your basement, did it not?
Well, there were a couple of students of my mom's, and this was... She eventually got to the point where she was able to teach in high school in the late 60s, early 70s. And so she had this kind of interesting phenomenon where a few students that she had from early years in grade school then became her students again in high school at a place called Clark High School in Las Vegas. And so some of those students who were very much influenced by a lot of the more militant black nationalist politics of the time. I'm thinking of two students in particular of hers, Jeannie Giles and Tommy Jones. And, sometimes they would meet in my mom's basement along with some of the other students who were involved.
What are you taking in through all of this? Are you feeling part of a revolution? Are you feeling moved to politics?
Well, I think... It was just the atmosphere that I grew up in. I was an only child, too. some of my mom's students became like older brothers and sisters for me. And so I looked up to them. And I also just knew that I felt from an early, I guess I just, I don't know, I don't want to, it's hard to look back on it now. But look, I mean, I remember when Martin Luther King was shot. I remember that being a major event. I remember my mom crying. I remember knowing that it had something deep and fundamental to do with me and with my life and my chances. I remember looking at Huntley and Brinkley and watching the reports and noticing how many people were killed in Vietnam this day or that day. And I knew that, you know, my mom had students who were in the Army. You know, there was a palpable effect and impact of these things on our lives. You know, I remember, you know, you grow up in an extended Black family that included, you know, not only my mom and all of her friends, but my father and his brothers and sisters. And the topics of conversation were really topics about survival, how to live, how to organize yourselves in a way that will allow you to survive the sort of, you know, the sort of brutal impact, you know, of racism on everybody's lives. And people lived that. So, and, you know, the distinction between a sort of the civil rights movement and a more sort of integrationist aspiration and the sort of Black nationalist movement, that distinction for me, I didn't feel it. I didn't experience it that way. And I certainly think that for my mom, it wasn't a simple distinction. I think she had a foot in both camps.
On the State of Things, talking to Fred Moten, a poet and professor of modern poetry at Duke University. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with Fred Moten today, a poet and professor of modern poetry at Duke University. He talked about growing up in Las Vegas during what we would call the civil rights movement. Your mother very active. You eventually got accepted to Harvard. Tell us about that.
Well, again, it all I think I keep saying it. I have to go back a little further, but My mom and my father divorced in, 1972. And then a few years later, my mother decided she wanted to go back to graduate school and get a PhD. So she was accepted, attended the University of Pittsburgh. So I lived in Pittsburgh for a couple of years, my first 2 years of high school. And then my grandfather got sick. So my mom decided to go back to Arkansas to try to help take care of him and my grandmother. And so I spent my last 2 years in a very small town that she grew up in, you know, Kingsland, Arkansas. And that's where I graduated from high school. And somehow I was applied to and was accepted at Harvard. And so when I moved to Harvard, it wasn't from Las Vegas, but from a very, very small town in Arkansas. And that was certainly a bit of a shock to the system.
I would imagine. And by way of Pittsburgh. So all of those experiences had to be different in a way. So what were your goals? What were your aspirations? You're at Harvard now. What are you going to do?
Well, again, you know, growing up in the atmosphere in which I grew up with my mom and the sort of political and social and also even artistic atmosphere. I really felt that that I was going to join a cohort of other young Black people who were going to Harvard to sort of train themselves to be a kind of, I don't know, revolutionary cohort, I'll say, not vanguard, I hope, but that we were being, you know, that we were going there to learn things that would allow us to change the world. That was my assumption. And certainly that was my aspiration. And I think that was pretty much the way I was raised.
And when you got there, you found?
It was not quite that way. Mm-hmm. I guess one way to think about it would be the difference between thinking of yourself as being destined to extend a kind of liberation struggle as opposed to thinking of yourself as the culmination of that struggle. I think about it in that way now. And certainly my desire now as well as then is to extend that struggle as opposed to thinking of myself as the end of that struggle or as opposed to thinking of oneself as that everybody fought, did all this fighting in the 60s so that I could go to Harvard and then go work for Goldman Sachs or whatever.
Well,
so or Duke University.
So that's the question. Is that what you found? I mean, as you looked around and
I think it was somewhat like that. You know, I certainly felt that way at that time.
Yeah.
And I was extremely kind of disappointed and increasingly angry about it. But I was 18.
Yeah.
And I'm 50 now, and I teach 18-year-olds. And I think probably I hope I'm a lot more generous and a lot less judgmental in my thinking now about students than I was back then.
Well, I wonder how much of that. I mean, the idea that you're there and you're finding other African-Americans who maybe you were hoping you would gather together and advance this movement, and you're finding people who are quite willing to settle in, make good lives for themselves. As you say, pointing back, thank you for opening the door for me. Now I'm going to live a good life.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that do you think is just projection? Now that you have the luxury of looking back, that you maybe didn't have a fire at the moment in yourself, and we're looking around saying, "Hey, wait a minute, wake up, everybody!" Meaning, wake up, Fred.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know that it was project. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's funny because my mom, you know. I think she was very concerned about what she thought of as my rebellious tendencies.
Mm.
I never thought of my rebellious tendencies as anything other than an expression of her rebellious tendencies. But she was very concerned that I'd be able to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
She knew what it was like, you know, to not be able to pay bills and to be on food stamps, you know, all these things. Some of them, you know, occurred as a function of my parents' divorce and her deciding to go back to school. But we were, you know, struggling. She was unemployed for about a year and a half right before I went to Harvard. You know, so she knew what it was like to struggle. We didn't come from from affluence at all. She went to college, but they paid for college by picking cotton, you know.
Well, so what was that like? Maybe that class difference, particularly coming directly from Arkansas. Yeah. Now you're at Harvard. That would have been a culture shock.
Well, that was definitely different. I mean, on two different levels. One that, you know, I mean, Harvard's just a place of tremendous wealth, and there were many very, very wealthy students there. And so that was a new thing that I was not around. It wasn't around in Arkansas, at least where I was, and certainly wasn't around even in Vegas. Although, you know, I think I probably went to school in Vegas with some kids who had a lot of money, but it was people in the gaming industry. It was a totally different, you know, kind of place for that kind of wealth to come from. But I also didn't know, you know, there's a certain kind of, you know, sort of black middle class existence that, again, I was not very tied to or connected to in Las Vegas. And so that was a bit of a shock, too. And I realized when I got up there that kids who came from a, you know, more or less working class existence, or what an old teacher of mine, Martin Kilson, calls the coping strata, you know, I think by which he means the people who are one paycheck away from disaster or something.
Yeah.
There weren't that many of us there. And that was different. You know, there were kinds of social rituals and social groups that I knew nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this sort of more or less famous, at least within the black community, sort of social group of, you know, young emergent teenage people called Jack and Jill. You know, it's
mm-hmm.
kind of I had no idea that there was such a thing as Jack and Jill. So these were things that I had to learn and to become aware of. And I imagine that in some ways these are differences that impacted maybe the difference between the way that I thought and the way that some of those other kids might have thought.
You didn't do too well that first try.
Well, it was for many reasons. I mean, the school that I went to in Arkansas was not equipped with the kinds of, you know, advanced placement sort of apparatuses that kind of keep kids, you know, on track to develop a certain set of work habits that might be useful in a school like Harvard. So I just hadn't done much work, you know, I guess you could say, for a couple of years when I went up there. And also between that and sort of shock of the social differences and just playing football, and also because I was very involved in some extracurricular sorts of political activities, by the time the second semester came around, I just had more important things to do than go to class, you know. So
you flunked out.
Yeah, I flunked out. Yeah. I think I had 3 F's my second semester, and I don't know what the other grade was. Anyway, but
kind of doesn't matter after
that,
does it?
Yeah, it didn't matter. So
you find yourself back in Nevada, yeah, and you're working at the test site as a janitor.
Yeah, my mom had a friend who was in the personnel office for the prime contractor for the test site. So I actually had a job doing the same thing as my father did when he first moved to Nevada, my father with the ninth grade education. And I found myself, you know, cleaning toilets and looking at my reflection in the mirror of the bathrooms at the, you know. And, you know, it was certainly, you know, not what I had expected.
Well, you said that, too, there was a culture there of sort of not getting anything done that you.
Well, it was, I wouldn't say that. I would say it was more like we had to work for 8 hours a day, but we didn't necessarily have 8 hours worth of work to mm-hmm. do. And so what we did was find other things to do. And I was very, very fortunate. One of the people that I worked with was a guy named Frank Fitzpatrick from Red Hook in Brooklyn. And he was just, he had a philosophical bent, I would say. And we would just we'd do our work and then we'd get in the truck and just drive and talk. And he was also in a certain sense, he was at that time a recovering alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And we were, I guess, both trying to, you know, sort of redeem ourselves or trying to get ourselves on track. You know, he was actively attempting to get back with his family, which he eventually did, and become a more functional, you know, positive part of their lives. And I was just trying to figure out how I could get back to school and hopefully still, you know, you know, just not disappoint my mom.
You hadn't given up at that point. You didn't think
I knew that there was probably I would be able to go back, right, or at least that was my feeling. But I also, you know, I definitely needed some time away and I needed to try to get some things straight, you know, and kind of think through some things. And also the best thing, I guess, for me was that at that point I realized that, you know, that there were certain things that I had been involved in, mainly playing football as part of my time at my freshman year at Harvard, but also thinking that I wanted to be like maybe an economics major. I declared economics and sociology double major, you know, and was interested at that point in trying to do some sort of developmental economics or something, mm-hmm. some kind of radical economics. And what I realized is that, you know, I was probably much more interested in literature than those things.
And you were doing a lot of reading at this time.
I was doing a lot of reading.
Is this when you encountered Amiri Baraka, or you'd been familiar with his work?
I knew Baraka's work before because my mom had, you know, she had a lot of books. She had a great anthology that Baraka wrote, co-edited with Larry Neal, called Black Fire. There was a kind of anthology of black arts writing. And then she also had this other great anthology called Black Voices that I think was edited by a guy named Chapman, I believe. And so I grew up reading those texts and Langston Hughes and all that stuff. So I knew about that stuff and had a kind of feeling for it. But I didn't know that that's what I wanted to kind of devote my life to in that way until that year, I think.
Well, so, and what happened? I mean, again, it's one thing to be familiar with that kind of work, know it's important. Did it strike you? Did one particular work grab you? What happened, do you think?
Well, it's a kind of complicated itinerary, but there is a poem by Baraka called Preface to a 20-Volume Suicide Note, which is from, I think, one of his first books, maybe first full-length book, which has also got the same title. And I remember that poem in particular as being, you know, at that point, I was a little sad and a little despairing, you know, and it was, you know, the vague sort of, you know, a vaguely existential despair that I was kind of living under. And that poem certainly struck me. But I think it also struck me because I saw, at least at that moment in his work, a very intense kind of affinity with T.S. Eliot's work. And for lack of a better word, there was some stuff that happened at the end of my freshman year that got me invested in Elliot in a certain kind of way. I went to see Apocalypse Now. And in Apocalypse Now, you know, there's this it's sort of filmic version of Heart of Darkness, the Conrad story. Mm-hmm. Elliot had a certain relation to Conrad through the Hollow Man. Hollow Man is a poem that kind of shows up at a certain way, you know, Brando reading that poem in the movie. Mm-hmm. And there was this whole kind of little constellation of Elliot, Conrad, Dante, and then Baraka. And that kind of got me kickstarted, I guess.
And you also say that your influences, including the poets of the Black Arts movement like Amiri Baraka, your influences include Wallace Stevens and Emily Dickinson as well as T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, I mean, Eliot was definitely a major influence early on and less so now, I would say, although I still hear his cadence in my stuff in a lot of ways that it's just ingrained. But over the course of time, especially after my sophomore year in college, Wallace Stevens was very important to me and still is. And I would say maybe in the last 5 or 6 years, really since I've been at Duke and very much under the influence of a colleague of mine named Joe Donahue, who's a great American contemporary poet who lives around the corner from me here in Durham, I've kind of discovered Dickinson and immersed myself in her work in a much more intense way. And also under the influence of my wife as well, who's very much interested in Dickinson, by way of another great contemporary American poet and critic named Susan Howe. So,
you know, the connection you drew between that first poem that you say really you heard in a different way and the other poets, I think gets at a critique that we often hear about the Black Arts movement, that it is particularly a movement for and about African Americans, and in that way, maybe not fully artistic in its bloom. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that that's a kind of nonsense, if it is a critique at all, because of what you just said, that there are so many connections and so many corollaries that take you places apart from a particular movement, but that start with that movement and aren't embarrassed by the connection to a particular experience. And if we can't feel that, if we can't bring ourselves to it in our own way, you know, it seems to me the impoverishment is ours, not the poet's.
I definitely agree with that. I mean, I believe that, you know, poetry, the work of individual poets as well as the work of poets in a kind of community or a school, you know, they emerge out of very specific and particular experience. I mean, you know, I love English Renaissance literature, Shakespeare and Ben Jonson and John Donne. And, you know, that poetry emerges out of a very specific experience. It is also at the same time extraordinarily rich. It emerges out of a very specific kind of erudition. It's both particular to that time and place, as well as influenced by classical literature and European literature from other countries. And I would say the same thing about the Black Arts movement. It comes from a certain place, and it comes from a certain group of writers who are very much concerned with the social and aesthetic and intellectual development of a particular group of people at a particular time who are living under particular constraints. But it draws from all over the place, from all over the world, from all kinds of different genres of art in addition to just literature. And its aesthetic and political and social impact is there and open for whoever wants to claim it.
You talked about the influence, too, on your cadence and on your work in general. I want to play a clip from an Amiri Baraka poem where he's reading from As a Possible Lover.
As a possible lover practices silence, the way of wind bursting its early lull, cold morning to night, we go so slowly without thought to ourselves. Enough to have thought tonight, nothing finishes it. What you are will have no certainty or end, that you will stay where you are, a human, gentle wisp of life. Ah, practices loneliness as a virtue, a single specious need to keep what you have never really had.
Amiri Baraka, As a Possible Lover. Can you talk about that poem?
Well, this is a poem that's usually considered part of, I guess, what would be Baraka's sort of pre-Black Arts manifestation. So that he's very much influenced by a kind of confluence of aesthetic innovations that are occurring in modern in American poetry in the 1950s. The Black Mountain School, the New York School poets, the Beat poets. And so the kinds of syntactic disjunctures, you know, sort of the sense of the poem beginning with the middle of a sentence, the sort of fragmentary phrasing of the poem could be connected to those poetic movements. But I think it's also a moment in which, even though Baraka is fully immersed in those particular, in that particular poetic milieu, he's also very much influenced by Black music, in particular by jazz and blues, and the much more and the more experimental forms of Black music that sort of emerged not only as bebop in the 40s, but through the era that gets called the free jazz era in the early 60s and mid 60s and 70s. And so that kind of music that one hears in Baraka's poetry is very much influenced there too. I mean, I think stylistically and in terms of form, I think there's a lot of continuity between the sort of pre-Black arts Baraka and the post-Black arts Baraka. At the level of content, obviously, there's a bunch of different kinds of extensions of that work. But Baraka as a political poet seems to me to be somebody that you can trace back to the late 50s, early 60s. And in particular, in his own autobiography, he talks about the importance of a trip to Cuba in 1960. And wrote a very important essay called Cuba Libre that talks about that experience. It talks about his emerging into a more explicit political consciousness. So
on the state of things today, we'll complete that thought when we return with Fred Moten, a poet and professor of modern poetry at Duke University. We'll take a break and be right back. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Fred Moten, poet, professor of modern poetry at Duke University. So, okay, first time around at Harvard, not so good. End up working as a janitor. You discover poetry, of all things. Now, are you serious about trying to make a living at this? What's your next step?
Well, I mean, again, so much of everything for me goes back to my mom. My mom was a school teacher. I never believed that there could ever be anything as noble, you know. Part of it, too, again, being an only child and the fact that her students were a real part of my life and came to our house and were sort of surrogate older siblings for me. And so I always thought that even when I was going to major in economics, it was always with the assumption that I would go to grad school and maybe try to become a professor. So that part never changed. It was just that I realized that what I had more of an affinity for, I think, was literature. So I kind of got back into the swing of thinking that grad school was an option for me, but also thinking, never really thinking that I wanted to do anything else. There was never some alternative pathway that I thought. I think maybe under a certain inertia, I could have ended up in law school or something. You know, just as a function of not having another choice. But that was always pretty much what I thought I wanted to do.
Did you see your poetry the way you saw perhaps your economics and sociology initially as furthering a kind of revolution, furthering a movement?
I thought that for me, I began to see the import. I really had this feeling that education is crucial, not education in the sense of achieving or fostering a kind of upward mobility within an already existing system or structure, but rather education as a space where people could begin to think and to imagine and to theorize another way of living, another way of being in the world. And that was really what I felt my contribution could be, and I still pretty much think that. And so it was in the study of poetry and in thinking about the relation between poetic creativity and the kinds of social creativity that are necessary for people to develop new ways of living, new sustainable, free, liberatory, at least, ways of living. That's what I thought. For me, the poetry, my own writing, was always I always felt very sort of amateurish about it, in the sense that I loved to write and it was something that I was going to do anyway, but I never thought of it as something that I was going to make a living at. And I didn't really even think about it as something that which was necessarily going to be that my writing was a kind of poetic standard bearing mechanism for a certain kind of political aspirations. I believe that my poetry contains those social and political aspirations, but not in such a way as to be like the specific, you know, expression of those aspirations over against some other kind of expression.
Or we're not going to read this poem and storm the barricades necessarily. No. Or that's not the goal. Or is it?
Well, it's funny. I guess in a weird way, I think maybe this is something that I hadn't ever explicitly thought about before. What is the relationship between my poetry and social revolution? I don't know. I do know that I do believe that my poetry, what I want it to be, is part of a general aesthetic and intellectual field or contribution that's bound up with that transformation.
Well, what you said earlier is not insignificant, the idea that the process of writing poetry requires a certain liberation and a freedom of mind that is the prerequisite of any social revolution. If each of us can't be in that space where our minds are totally transformed, then the idea that we can create a new environment for ourselves, economic and social and political, is preposterous. So you start there, and as an example, not a bad thought. Not a bad thought, well, whatever the output is and whatever the actual, you know, the product does.
Well, there's a great Kenyan writer named Ngugi Wa Thiong'o who wrote a book about a famous essay called Decolonizing the Mind. And I think it's very much bound up with the notion that you say that the first step is a kind of liberation of the mind. And I would I think I do pretty much believe that. I think I would probably say it in a slightly different way, that it's if the writing of poetry requires a kind of liberation of mind, then what I would say is I don't think that the writing of poetry requires a liberation of the mind, but the writing of poetry contributes to the liberation of mind. But I also believe that this is also the case for the reading of poetry. So that when I'm teaching, it's about what does it mean for us to get together as a kind of social group, you know, to read and write together? How does that help to prepare us, right, for the other kinds of issues that we need to think about and to think through together? Right.
So we don't have to write our Declaration of Independence, be free, and then say, ah, now I can write poetry. But the act of poetry brings us ever closer to that kind of freedom.
I think so.
The project itself. Would you read a poem for us?
Okay. This is called B. Jenkins. And it's a title poem from a book called B. Jenkins, and B. Jenkins is my mom. Okay. B. Jenkins. Her territory sunflower. Insurgent floor time in real time in the Field Museum. Bertha Lee in her lyric ways in her urban plan. Up and down the regular highway in every two-tone station, passing through to cure, for preservation to unfold it all away. She put the new thing in the open cell, one more time about the theory of who we are. In the names, away in blocks with double names to interrupt and gather, kept dancing in tight circles between break and secret, vaulted with records in our basement, where the long-haired hippies and Afro-blacks all get together across the tracks and they party, everybody sown like grain and touched in stride. Now the cold new reckoning is tired, and you've been waiting for a preferential song. The multiplex should be in the frame like bodies in a house way back in the woods, flared and suspended projects like the real thing, posed for the midnight trill. Essential shtetl of the world stage, born way before you was born, move the administered word by breathing to hand beautiful edge around.
Fred Moten reading his poem, B. Jenkins. It's a poem you said about your mother. What does your mother think of your poetry?
Well, she, I wrote this poem after my mom passed away and as a kind of elegy, and that whole book really is a kind of elegy to her in the form of portraits of other people who she made possible for me to know, I suppose you could say, even if she didn't know them themselves. And I guess in a way, that's maybe the way to think about her relation to my poetry, is that everything from it, everything in the poetry is a function of her, it seems to me, and her music, the way she spoke, her wit, but also things that she made possible for me to know, even if she didn't know those things. Like my mother probably never, I don't think she ever read Jacques Derrida, this sort of great French philosopher, but she made it possible for me to read Derrida, and she made it possible for me to read Derrida in the way that I do.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
So I think there's probably a lot of stuff going on in my poetry that my mom would have been like, I don't know, what is this boy talking about? And I would always look at, say, you know, but that's just you, you know. So we didn't really get a chance to have a big, long, full, deep, rich engagement at that with that question. But I believe that if she were still here and had time to, we had time to work through it and talk about it, she would recognize herself in it and then recognize herself as somebody who should be in poetry.
Well, you talk about, I think you've told a story about what I believe was the last time you saw your mother and her in talking about your poetry.
Not quite the last time, but the last time I saw her when she was healthy, you know, really just a week or so before she died. I published a chapbook called Arkansas, and she came to New York where I was teaching at the time for a sort of book party launching of that book along with some other books at the publisher. Engaged in working with. And it was just one of those times where there were a bunch of people reading and people were kind of using language that maybe my mom would not have understood to be properly poetic or public language and talking about things that she might not have thought people should be talking about in public, you know. And at one point I was taking her back to her hotel and she just sort of said, well, I see now I have to let you go. And it wasn't like she was mad. It was just that I was into some stuff that she wasn't into. Mm-hmm. And she had to, you know. So that was about a week before she passed.
Well, what about your father's influence on all of this and the political activism? What's he making of all this when it was happening back in Las Vegas?
Well, my father was, again, he was, he went to the ninth grade. He came from a big extended family from Louisiana that moved to Las Vegas in the 50s. I think he was a really intelligent person, and I think he had his own pretty deep and intense political commitments. And he was very, I think, supportive, you know, in many ways of my mom's political activities. And one way that support took was that he did a lot of what I would call the sort of maternal or the normatively understood maternal work, you know. Mm-hmm. He got me dressed for school and he, you know, stuff like that. Cooked breakfast in the morning, in addition to his jobs that he had. So I think he was ahead of his time in many ways in that respect, you know, independently of whatever difficulties he and my mom had, you know. And those difficulties were such that, you know, I always felt a kind of intense allegiance to my mom. Mm-hmm. And still do. But increasingly over the course of time, I have a lot more respect and I think I'm able to think a lot more generously about what he did and what he contributed. And I think he probably had an even more intense kind of commitment to my education, or I shouldn't say more intense, but equally intense, coming from a different place.
Well, particularly if he had to play a different role to see that it happened, he had to really change roles to support all that was going on in the household.
Yeah. He was also a really keen and insightful listener especially to music. I remember he would say these things that still stick with me as like things that I still try to figure out exactly what they mean because I know they mean something deep and I still haven't quite caught up. Like my mom loved Nancy Wilson, a great vocalist. And my father would say stuff like, Nancy Wilson can't sing, but she can style.
Mm.
And I'm still trying to figure out what this... I intuitively, I believe it to be true somehow.
Yeah.
You know? But I still have to think through it.
Forgive me, but that could be a haunting statement for a poet, it seems to me. Something about form and something about content.
Yeah. It's in a poem somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm inveterate. Thief when it comes to that kind of stuff. But my father, and similar to my oldest son, they have the capacity to say these things that make you kind of ruffle your brow for 5 or 6 years, you know. So.
Till it makes its way into your poem. Yeah. You said something earlier about having an aspiration to find a role for yourself that was beyond just providing the comfort within the normal milieu. You could live a very comfortable existence in this academy called Duke and write poetry and teach poetry. Mm-hmm. Do you feel you have a different role? Do you have a different mission, do you feel, or not?
No, I mean, I still believe, first of all, I believe more intensely than I did before in the importance of thinking and of study, and the importance of thinking and study to liberation, that these things are bound up with one another in ways that that I'm still trying to consider and trying to involve myself in. Duke is in many ways a place of great privilege. My sense of Duke is also in many ways a place of great underprivilege. The trouble is that not very many people at Duke know how to understand their underprivilege and how that impacts education and how that impacts thinking.
Are you talking about the underprivilege of those who might have material wealth?
Yeah. Certainly having material wealth and material advantages puts one at a disadvantage when it comes to thinking about what it is that you don't have. I mean, in the freedom schools in Mississippi during the early 60s, the civil rights movement there, you know, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee instituted or helped to make the freedom schools. And one of the things that the freedom schools would talk about in their own sort of meditations on their curriculum, it asks themselves questions like, what do we have, what do we don't have that we need? What do we not have that we would like to get? But they also ask themselves the question, you know, what do we have that we want to keep? You know, what is it that we don't have that we don't want? And what that presupposes is that people who are generally thought of as living lives of deprivation have things. They have something, and they don't necessarily want everything that those who are privileged have. So I think that one of the fundamental things that I find that my students at Duke sort of don't quite have are some narratives that help them to explain certain aspects of their lives that are really profoundly problematic. The incidence of eating disorders amongst women students at Duke is like, you know, that it's a high number. Incidents of sexual violence, high number. I don't associate these kinds of things with privilege, you know. Right. But you need to have a way of understanding, you know, how it is that you're lucky to be at Duke, and yeah, it's great, and yeah, you worked hard to get here, but it's not all good.
It's
and
interesting.
You have to have a way of thinking about that.
It's interesting when those disabilities or some tendencies to some addictions get associated with wealth, and they become normative. So that if you drink too much or take prescription medicine, that's not a signal of a problem. That's just what we do. Yeah. Other kinds of substance abuse are criminalized, and when we see how that ends up, depends.
But the number of students at Duke who are on, let's call them non-recreational drugs, coping drugs or whatever. That again indicates to me that there's an issue and a problem. But as I said, I mean, I think that there's issues there. I'm actually leaving Duke to go to a new job in California at a state school. And the state school is understood to be a poor school relatively. Mm-hmm. But I'm actually hoping to find a lot of richness at this school that maybe there wasn't quite. That I have not been able to quite find at Duke. So,
Fred Moten, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Fred Moten, poet and professor of modern poetry at Duke University, thank you for listening to The State of Things on North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.